أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لأهله والصلاة على أهلها واللعنة على من استحقها إلى يوم الدين. We are starting our second segment of our discussion, this presentation on Salah. And if you remember, let's go to the beginning, walk around so that you can have a bird's eye view of the whole presentation once again, which I mentioned in the beginning. So we are done till the importance of the eyes of importance of Salah in the eyes of the Holy Quran, importance of Salah in the eyes of the Prophet and Abu Bakr Salah, and we mentioned the kinds of Salah, the wajib ones, which are six, and then now we are starting with four and five, and probably till six. And this, these 3 points, inshallah, will be covered in this segment, and then the 7 to 10, and last four, inshallah, will be mentioned in the last segment of this presentation. So now we are going to start with this fourth one, which is Sharahat Sihhat al-Salah. That means the conditions for the correctness of the prayers, which are actually 14, and then some descriptions about the types of wajibat and the compulsory parts of the prayers. So, Sharahat of the Sihhat al-Salah, that means the second is correctness of the prayer. These are 14 conditions. If we have to need, we have to need these 14 conditions for the validity of our prayers. Otherwise, the prayers is categorized as batil, null, and void. So these are for the correctness. If we do it, our prayers are then considered to be sahiha, and correct. Otherwise, it's batil. It's incorrect. It didn't happen. But first, we have to do the prayers in the correct way, and in addition to that, we have the next segment of conditions which we will mention about the qabool of the salat, that means acceptance in the eyes of Allah. These are certain things more than this. Acceptance of the sharaat of acceptance, the conditions of acceptance are something more and in addition to these. So let's first learn the conditions that are necessary for the validity of and correctness of our prayers. The first one is the taharat. I just mentioned a while ago about the two kinds of taharat, taharat ma'iyya and turabiyya, water-based cleanliness and soil-based cleanliness. Taharat ma'iyya and turabiyya. And the taharat ma'iyya was further divided into those two kinds of wudu and ghusl. The water-based taharat and the turabiyya, that means the soil-based taharat. And then this one, water one, was further divided into wudu. It can be through the wudu or through the ghusl, the Islamic way of washing our body. So whichever one is applicable in your case. Sometimes we have to do the turabi one, that is the tayammum. Sometimes the sharia obliges us to do wudu. Sometimes we have to do the ghusl. Whatever is applicable in your case. But the bottom line, we have to have the taharat in whatever forms it may be, whatever form it may be applicable in our case. So sometimes, you may end up doing two of them together. Like for instance, you do tayammum and water was not available for you. So in the middle, now you did the tayammum and you are starting to say Takbiratul Ihram, Allahu, you didn't say Akbar yet. And one of your friends came rushing towards you, he brought water. The Sharia says your tayammum became batil automatically, because you did the tayammum based on the fact that the water was not available. Now you find your friend is running towards you, he is bringing water. So now the conditions have changed. You already did the tayammum. You cannot say, well, the same tayammum is valid, so let me start the praise and say Al Akbar, just enter into the praise. No, the Rambam is gone. As soon as the water is available, the foundation which allowed you to do the Tayammum, that basis and that foundation is no longer there. Conditions have changed. So you have to do the wudu in that place and then start. Basically, Tahara is necessary. And then we have the second one, which is Istiqbalul Qibla, facing towards the Qibla. This is another very important thing we need to remember. We need to face the Qibla. Qibla is a concept in Islam. And the concept of Qibla, if we understood, actually the Qibla is nothing but the Holy Kaaba. This is the Holy Kaaba, let's suppose. So that's the real Qibla for the entire world. But we cannot see the Holy Kaaba unless and until we are inside that Holy Mosque, you know, which is around the Kaaba. So that's the Safa and Marwa. So this is the Holy Mosque, which we call Al-Masjid Al-Haram. The respected Haram means the one which has Qurbat and respect. So that's the root word derived from the Qurbat, the root word of Qurbat. So the most respectable mosque, Masjid Al-Haram. So you can see that your the Qibla actually is Kaaba. But this Qibla is unseeable except for those who are inside the Masjid Al-Haram. So you have to be inside the Masjid to see the Kaaba. Isn't that right? So if you are standing here, let's suppose here is the wall of the Masjid, you are standing here. Can you see the Kaaba? Of course not. So what is your Qibla if you are standing here? You cannot see the Kaaba. If you are standing here, you cannot see the Kaaba. The Sharia says your Qibla is the Masjid Al-Haram. Just face towards the Masjid Al-Haram. Of course, this is Kaaba in the center of the Masjid. So for those people who are inside the Masjid Al-Haram, their Qibla is Kaaba itself. Actually, the Qibla is Kaaba in the real sense. But for those who are outside the Masjid, who are unable to see the Kaaba, the Sharia cannot oblige you to do a duty with you which is beyond your reach. So you cannot see the Kaaba if somebody thinks that in every case I have to be exactly facing towards Kaaba, it's never going to happen, because if you draw a straight line, maybe it passes from here. If you are standing here and you draw a straight line, maybe it passes from here. Isn't that right? So, but that was not your obligation. This is taklifu ma la yutaq, which is mahal in Islam. This is something Allah doesn't oblige us to do a thing which is beyond our reach, but doable for us. So for those people who are outside the Masjid, who are unable to see the Kaaba itself, which is actually the real Qibla, but since we are unable to determine that, so our Qibla is the Masjid. Now for those of the people who are living in the greater metropolis around the Makkah, let's suppose there are so many of those buildings and all that, and some of those buildings have been constructed by Al Saud, higher than the Holy Kaaba, which is condemned in Islam. La yurfa'u binahum fawq al-Kaaba. The hadith of the Prophet says, La yurfa'u binahum fawq al-Kaaba. No construction should be made higher than the Kaaba. La yurfa'u binahum fawq al-Kaaba. So the hadith says that no construction should be made higher than the Kaaba. But they are Ahl al-Saud who are making their constructions higher to the Kaaba right next to it. So the whole religion is messed up for them. This is just one of the tip of the iceberg. So nothing of surprise. So if you are in the greater metropolis of Makkah and there are so many different buildings which are higher than Kaaba, you cannot even see the Masjid al-Haram. So what is the Qibla for you? If you are not, this is just an example of the metropolis of Makkah, and the same is applicable to other cities in the world and other countries in the world who are of course unable to see not just the Kaaba, but also they're unable to see the Masjid al-Haram. So the Sharia says for all the rest of the people who are unable to see the Kaaba and the Masjid al-Haram, their Qibla is the city of Makkah. just faced towards the direction of the city of Makkah. That's why in Arabic we use the word Jihatul Qibla. So basically you have to be in the direction towards the Qibla. As long as you are in the direction towards the Qibla, wherever you may be on earth, that is fine. So if here we are, so of course, let's suppose, you know, this is the North America, and here is South America, okay? So here is the Europe, and okay, this is Europe is something like this, and this is Africa, okay? And here is Saudi Arabia, called Saudi Arabia, and so on, and this is all Asia, in Japan, and all that, that's India. So if you are living here, so you have to face this Makkah, direction of the city of Makkah here, even though if the line passes through the globe, you have to find the shortest distance that reaches towards the direction of Kaaba, direction of Makkah. So that's why we know that the shortest distance is northeast. So the Qibla for the entire North America is northeast. That is the shortest direction. If you look at the southeast segment, that will be longer than the northeast. So if you look at the, they call it the Lambert Azimuthal, Lambert Azimuthal Equal Area Projection. That's one of the best projections to understand the map and the real dimensions of the continents. So if you like look at the Mercator projection, this is one of the worst projections in terms of understanding the distances and the size and the magnitude of the continents. So you won't be able to understand that North America's Qibla is northeast if you are looking at a map in the Mercator projection. No way. You cannot understand that. You have to either look at take a globe in your hands, or you look at a Lambert Azimuthal Equal Area Projection, which has a better and a very closer picture of the real world. So when you look at the real projection, you would realize, so for those of the people who are away from Makkah, their Qibla is just to face towards the Jihatul Qibla, direction of Kaaba, direction of Makkah, and that's enough. Even though if you draw a straight line, it may pass right of the city of Mecca or left of the city of Mecca. Of course, that's fine, that's natural. We cannot make sure the line crosses exactly on top of the city of Mecca. This is the taklif of ala yuqaf, an obligation not doable, and that any obligation which is not doable has never been put on our neck in the Sharia. So this is the Kaaba Qibla is compulsory. You can just buy a $2 compass, a $5 compass, it's a matter of importance. And make sure wherever you go, in North America, you can just make sure, find, also, of course, you can find your degrees towards the east, north towards the east, and pray. So, but we have to face towards Makkah. And it's a long discussion, I won't go into details, a whole bunch of details told in the Sharia for somebody who doesn't know at all. There are so many signs that we have to discover. You have to look at the mosque, you have to first inquire from the Muslim people around you, get the witnesses. If you couldn't find nothing, just look at the Muslim graveyard and find out what's the direction of the graves of the people buried there. This is one of another sign. And you can basically a whole bunch of list of things with which we can discover the direction of Makkah. And for those of the people who are stuck in a desert or in a Amazon forest or Papua New Guinea rainforest, wherever where you are totally unable to discover where you are, and for those people, they are obliged in the Sharia to pray in four directions. They will first pray their Dhuhr prayers in all the four directions, and then they will pray their Asr prayers in all the four directions. There is no need to pray in eight, because less than 90 degrees of deviation from the Qibla, which is unintentional deviation, is accepted. So if you pray in four directions, that's okay. So this is just a very, very short summary of the details of the concept of Qibla. Then we have the subtle of the pain. That means covering our private parts. It's wajib for men, also for women, but women have something more, so I have just singled out men here, because this is the minimum applicable for men. For the women, it's hair, satrul aban. That means not just the private part, but the entire body, because al-barakatu kulluha awratun. That's what we said in the books of fiqh, that the entire body has to be treated like that. So it has the same ruling, the whole body has to be covered. It's wajib to cover for a woman, wajib for her to cover her entire body except wajh and kafan. Wajh means face, and kafan means to do two hands below the wrists. Face, as much amount of face as it is wajib in the wudu to wash, starting from the beginning of the roots of the hair till the tip of the chin. So you have to cover this much also in the hijab when you are praying, and even beyond the prayer, you have to cover this segment also. This much, which is wajib. It's not wajib to wash hair in the wudu. So they can only expose this much face, which is wajib to wash in the wudu. Only this much. So this is an exact. They also have to cover their feet from the non-mahram people. They can keep the feet open during the prayers if there's no non-mahram present, or there's no likelihood of a non-mahram to show up all of a sudden. So if there is a non-mahram present, or there is a likelihood in ihtimal a non-mahram may appear all of a sudden, then they have to wajib to even cover their feet. So women have to cover their whole body. They can only expose wajh and kafan, face and the two hands below the wrists only in the prayers. If they expose, the prayers will become batil. There are some women who have their hair visible, or their neck visible, or their hand sleeves are this much, so part of their hands are visible, their prayers will be batil. Let's be very clear about it. So, also if in the middle of the prayers, if a woman understands that, well, the scarf, head covering has moved and the hair has started to become visible, as soon as you get to know that the hair has become visible, it will be wajib on her to cover it ASAP. If she covers it immediately, her prayers would be saved. If she delays in hiding her hair or hiding the rest of the body, which is wajib to be covered, if she delays intentionally, the prayers will become batil. So then she has to start it all over again. So number five, fifth condition is taharatul badan. That means the body has to be tahir and pak, Islamic cleanliness. I intensely mentioned that because the word cleanliness is not going to define the Islamic definition of tahara, in any form. So Islamic way of cleaning our body, the first chapter of our Sharia is taharat. When you open up any book of fiqh, you find chapter number one is taharat. Islam has so much importance for cleanliness, spiritual and physical, both aspects. So cleanliness of the body in the Islamic sense of the word is wajib for the prayer. So if my body is najis, I cannot start the prayer. I have to first clean my body and clean and make it Islamically tahir and pak, and then I can start my prayers. You cannot start your prayer with the najis body. If you have najasat and you don't have water to clean it, then basically you would be obliged to find water. If you are unable to find it, then it will be ihtiyatan, you should pray with the najis body. But when you go back home and you find water, it will be wajib on you to pray after cleaning your body, because even if you pray with the najis badan and body, it is not accepted. It's not correct, it's batil. So this is the condition for the correctness. And then we have number six is the taharat of nibas. That means your dress has to be tahir and bath and clean. If you have some najasat in the dress, you have to change it at the time of prayers. If you cannot change it, clean it. If you cannot change it, then make it pak, make it tahir, clean it. Islamically, in the ways, certain things we clean by washing water after the izalatul najasa, izalatul aslin najasa, after removing the main najasat. certain things we clear by washing once and squeezing it, certain things we clear by washing twice, certain things we clear by washing three times, certain things we have to use the soil plus water for cleaning. So a whole bunch of things which we did discuss in the fit classes for those of those sisters and brothers who were present in the Wednesdays and Thursdays fit classes. So that's not the subject of our presentation to talk about Tahara and its details. So we have to have Tahara of Libas, which is compulsory, otherwise the Salat is batila, it's batil and invalid. Now there's one exception about the Libas. If you have blood on your dress, which is less than the amount of the nail of your thumb, blood is batil, blood is najis, yes, but this much blood is exempt. It is najis, but you can still pray in a dress which has a blood less than the amount of the nail of your thumb. This is an istisna. You can pray with that najasat on your libas, on your dress. It is still najis, but this much is allowed. You can clean it later on, and you don't have to repeat your prayer. If it is less than the nail of your thumb. Number seven is the dress being mubah. Mubah means the owner of the dress has permitted you to wear it, to use it, to do tasarruf in that dress. If I have borrowed a dress, if I have taken a dress from somebody, if I got it from a shop, I didn't pay him back, didn't pay the money, I don't even intend to pay him the money. Or I took your clothes and I never asked your permission. But if the owner of the dress doesn't give me the permission, of course my dress will be batil. No question about that, it's so clear. You know, Islam doesn't allow us to use anything which is not ours. So, then the eighth condition, we just mentioned seven here. We are about to seven, and then we go to the eighth condition of Sihat al-Salah, correctness of the prayers. Then we have the dress should not be made of a dead animal. Any part of the dead animal's body, meta, murdar, should not be part of our dress. So if we have like tags and logos of jeans which are made of non-halal, non-Islamically slaughtered animals, even though they may be halal meat animals, like if the leather belongs to a goat, but it was not slaughtered Islamically with the five conditions that we have in the Sharia. So if those five conditions were not met, although it may be a halal meat animal, but the leather will still be najis. So if that leather is part of your dress in the prayers, of course your prayers will be batil. So you have to take that, there may be one or two mujtahids who you may find, you know, I'm talking about the mainstream opinion of 99.999% of our mujtahids. For every matter you can find some differences of opinion. We are not here to talk, go into the details of that. This is the mainstream opinion of 99.999% of our mujtahids. So, and then we have condition number nine, the dress should not be made from a haram meat animal. That's another thing. That's a dead animal, maita and mutar. It may be a halal meat animal also, but still, because let's suppose it's a goat leather. So goat is a goat died with a natural death, so it's a dead animal. It's maita and mutar. Although it's a halal meat animal, but because it's a dead animal, you cannot wear its leather. And then the ninth condition says the dress should not be from a haram meat animal. You know, anything which is haram, so you cannot use their parts in your dress. So from haram meat animal, although it may not be najis. Like some people have cats in their houses. Cat is not a najis animal. If you touch the cat with a wet hand, your hand is not going to become najis. Cat is not najis. But being najis or not being najis is a different thing. There's a different department. But we are right now talking about haram meat. We are not talking about if the animal is najis or bak, najis or tahir. Najis or tahir is a different department of discussion. Being haram meat and halal meat is a totally different scenario. So if an animal is haram meat animal like a cat, although it may be bak and tahir, But there shouldn't be any part of the halal meat edible on your dress. Like if you have the hair of a cat on your dress, which is very frequently found because cat drops the hair. Some people have cat as pets. It's never a good idea to keep a haram meat animal inside your house. So if you have it, keep it in a cage, like a parrot. Keep it in a cage. Don't allow the haram meat animal to wander everywhere and it drops the hair. You couldn't even know. Your socks can catch the hair. I go to the houses of some people, I have to take my abba and my socks off at their door before entering because they have cats and it's all over. You cannot avoid, simply, as simple as that. And you cannot even see sometimes, there's a black hair. So if you're wearing black socks and it's the black hair you own, but if you discover it after you are done the prayer, your prayers will be marked. So why bother to do such a thing? Let's show our Islamic maturity in our things. Let's not keep the haram meat animals inside of our house open. You know, this is a matter of Islamic awareness. So a dress should not be made from a haram meat animals or its parts, like its leather, its hair, its fur, its whatever. And tenth of all is a man should avoid wearing gold and pure silk dress. This is of course haram anyway for the men to wear even beyond the prayers. But if they wear in the prayers, a silk tie, for instance, a gold. So this, in addition to the fact that they will be doing a haram, their prayers is also batil. So they have to repeat their prayers. Some people give golden rings in the marriage to their son-in-law. Now, why are you trying to decide things which Allah made haram? So we cannot give the gold rings to your son-in-law. You love him, very good, that's something good, but stay within the limits. Let's give him something that he is allowed to wear. You know, it's haram for a man to wear the gold ring of pure silk dresses. Synthetic silk is not haram. So the prayers will also be batil. 11th is not wearing gold jewelry for men, which I, you know, made the jewelry and the dress, because they get him on the gold dress. Some of the dresses have golden threads. Especially if you look at the dresses of the Arab sheikhs in the Persian Gulf, wearing those abbas with all the golden lines there, and some of those abbas have gold threads in that. So gold dress is something we need to specifically mention it separately. Avoiding gold dress, and then wearing gold jewelry is another thing we should be remembering.